Kenneth Helfand has a picture in his office. It's a photo from World War I of a French soldier tending a rose bush in a trench. Now, why, in the midst of a war, would a soldier plant a rose bush? What compels this seemingly futile pursuit of beauty? Helfand looks at answers to these questions in his book Defiant Gardens. What makes these wartime gardens defiant?
I think we often think of gardens as places of just as retreat and gardens as pretty places and passive places, but gardens can also be sites of resistance and assertive places. That's why I call them defiant gardens. Mm.
We should be very clear. These are not what people think of as victory gardens. Those.
No, the gardens that I examined were gardens created during wartime, but not gardens at the home front. These were gardens that are created either at or near battlefields or in wartime circumstances.
Yeah. What surprised me, I have to confess, is that these wartime gardens are actually very common. They appear everywhere, but I've never heard of them before.
Well, I don't think anyone had. I got into this originally from a single photograph. I found a stereo photograph of gardens built behind the trenches of French soldiers in the First World War, and that was really my introduction to this. And I had this picture on my shelf for many years and kind of kept examining it and eventually started looking and trying to do some research about gardens during the First World War and then gardens during other wartime circumstances. And it turned out when I started doing research and started telling people also what I was interested in, they would connect me to things. They said, have you seen this? Do you know about that place? Have you read this diary? Have you read this journal? And gradually, this more comprehensive picture began to emerge.
You look at the pictures and you can see that the life around the garden is full of hardship. And yet there seems to be, I guess, in that growing space, some sign of hope.
You could just take a very ordinary garden, whether it's a vegetable garden or an ornamental garden, and you place it in a different context. If you place it in a condition where growing conditions are difficult, or it's surrounded by industry, it's surrounded by traffic, or in these instances, surrounded by the hellish environment of war, what we previously take for granted is magnified. So the basic character of the garden is essentially, I think, revealed to us in these horrific circumstances.
A lot of this seems to be about hope, but there is one section that seems to be about the opposite of hope. I guess at least it looks that way. The Jewish children mm-hmm. who tried to grow things in Lodz ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about that?
There's a description from a memoir from a teacher who did survive the Lodz ghetto, which was the second largest ghetto in Poland after the Warsaw ghetto, and it's just west of Warsaw. In this circumstance, she was a teacher, and she describes how when the children are being deported, and when people were being deported from the ghetto, they were well aware of their fate. They were well aware that they were not going to survive this experience, and they didn't necessarily know they were going to be exterminated, but they knew they were not going to survive. And she describes the children in the ghetto who had constructed a garden at their school, I believe, ripping up the plants that were in the ghetto and screaming at them, nothing will bloom, nothing will bloom, and literally stamping out the plants that were there. And I think what it represents is the fact that they realized, either directly or I think for the children just intuitively, that the growth of any plant represents hope. When we plant something in the ground, when we put a seed in the ground, we do it in the anticipation that it'll grow, that it'll reach fruition, that we'll be able to enjoy it or harvest it. And it represents the future. Any planting, in fact, represents that. And I think what the children intuitively understood was that they had no future and that hope was dying, and their way of, perhaps way of expressing that, was literally to destroy those plants.
Gets at the nature of human beings. I mean, you deal with this later in the book. At the end, you talk about the question that everybody asked during the years of fascism. How can one think about roses when the forests are burning? Mm-hmm. It's a fair question, but I guess that's part of the answer, isn't it? You have to think about the roses.
Well, the quote you're quoting from is from a group, from the International Congress of Modern Architects in the 1930s, and SIAM, which was C-I-A-M, this congress, had this saying, which was, how can one plant roses when the forests are burning? And it was a wonderful image, I think, and very powerful one. And then SIAM answered their own question, which was, how can one not plant roses when the forests are burning? And I think the lesson here, if one is looking for a lesson, is that the forests are always burning. There's something horrible happening always in the world, and certainly is right now. And that one can't just dwell on that. You still have to kind of make assertive and positive and I think hopeful actions and still have to recognize the most positive elements in the world. And the image of roses there clearly is an image of beauty and something that, you know, kind of sensory richness and an ideal.
Yeah, somewhere recently I just read about a battlefield and soldiers looking at it and watching the birds coming in to search through the downed trees for nuts, mm-hmm. and you realize nature does go on.
Nature does go on, and our projection of ourselves on nature, there are these remarkable descriptions from the First World War of soldiers looking across no man's land, and no man's land between the trenches was a place that literally was a hell, and it became in many ways the kind of 20th century's formative image of hell. And what gardens are, at least at one of the root kind of meanings of gardens, gardens are paradisical places. They represent paradise. And the closer you are to hell, if you will, the more accentuated the meaning of that paradise. So soldiers would look out and see a tree that was still not blasted and still surviving, or just literally just a single blade of grass they could find moving.
We've been talking about this, of course, in historical context, but it is mm-hmm. not exactly history, is it? There are soldiers in Iraq planting gardens these days.
There absolutely are, and I had the remarkable experience of emailing and with soldiers who were there, and particularly a group of National Guardsmen from North Dakota who were stationed near Tikrit in northern Iraq. And they described the fact of desiring, first of all, to create a garden. And the desire was based on several factors. One was to try and create something that reminded them of home. And there's actually a picture in the book of one soldier tending just a small patch of grass, you know, maybe about 10 square feet of grass, because that grass reminded him, actually was a soldier originally from Oregon, reminded him of the green of Oregon. And other soldiers, particularly a Sergeant Carl Quam from the Oregon National Guard, describes spending the day going out in your Humvee with all your armament on you and all, everything that's protecting you, dodging bombs literally, hoping to come back alive. It's 140 degrees, and then coming back to what he describes as garden time, and a time that could just be in the garden, reminding him of home, and something that would just take his kind of mind away from the circumstance of the war. And fortunately, he survived that and is now back home.
You know, on the other side of this, you have the story that came out just recently about the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay who mm-hmm. apparently acquired seeds and planted even a lemon tree against the orders of their prison guards.
Well, one of the things about a garden is it's very, very difficult to have a secret garden. Gardens need a place. They need materials. They need to be monitored and tended. They obviously need sunlight and water and so on. So most of the gardens that I'm talking about, certainly in POW camps or internment camps, had at least the tacit permission of whoever was in charge. And in fact, in most circumstances, at least in the 20th century, prisoners are allowed to have gardens and have created them. In Guantanamo, they're currently not allowed to do that. So what did they do? They planted seeds and they acquired seeds from their meals. So the little 2-inch lemon tree that's described there was from lemons from a meal. They've also acquired watermelon seeds and they've been trying to grow things. And certainly I can't see any reason why they shouldn't be allowed to do that.
As a landscape architect, you must find this a very affirming story to have been able to tell.
Remarkably so. And I've often told my students that landscape architecture is both a combination of a conservative and optimistic and progressive act. It's conservative because, not in the political sense, but in the sense that when you plant something, you do it in anticipation that someone will monitor it, someone will tend it, and certainly for anything that's large, like trees, that people will take care of it often long after you're dead. So it's a very optimistic profession, if you will. And often the work you do takes many, many years to reach fruition, and often you never get to see it reach fruition, so you have to have some faith in that. The stories here, I found remarkably, this combination of remarkably optimistic and remarkably hopeful and assertive, and at times also, frankly, remarkably depressing, because most of these people, certainly in the ghettos, did not survive. Many of the soldiers from the wars did not survive. So you realize that people were doing something positive and trying to do something assertive and in resistance, and they were not always successful at it.
Kenneth Helfand is the author of Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime.